Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Before we get into this podcast, which is about the business of us talking about things we've watched on screens recently, movies, TV shows, other ephemera, I want to talk to you about bonobo monkeys. Well, actually, it's not a monkey, it's a primate or a chimpanzee, depending on how specific you really want to get on these things. The bonobo is, as per a news report that came out a couple of days ago, apparently they've done some studies into the way that a bonobo primate, a chimpanzee, exists with other bonobos. And what they do as a animal is that they're actually really, really cooperative. So it doesn't matter if it's a stranger to them or if it's a, you know, beloved member of their bonobo pack. I don't think it's technically a pack that they live in, but, you know, whatever their social circles are, they're really, really cooperative. They help each other out. They're friendly. They want to know each other's opinions. And frankly, that is not what we do here on this program. This is a bonobo-free zone. Folks, this is Screen Watching.
This is not like TV-only battle.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey there, guys, girls, miscellaneous others. This is Screen Watching. It's a podcast where we don't respect each other's opinions. We are not cooperative. No. We're here out for our own opinions. In fact, we're not even listening to the other person. Simon Foster, how are you? Don't think I'm listening.
Well, I'm anti-bonobo because I don't adhere to any of their social norms, as you've pointed out. Excellent first opening. It puts everything into perspective for me now. Hello, everyone. Hello, Screen Watchers all over the world. We have a very busy week here on the Screen Watching podcast. I will be reviewing the most talked about film of the week. It's the Ridley Scott adaptation of the Napoleon story. And I've got some very choice words to say about that. Also, the new Aussie film Royal Hotel. What are you looking at, Dan Barrett?
Look, I'm going to take a gander at the return of Fargo for season five. And then also the brand new Netflix adaptation of their original drama Squid Game. They've turned it into a reality show called Squid Game. The Challenge, I think that's what it's called, something like that. The Squid Game reality show.
Going to talk
about that. I think you're going to chat about Caligula. We're going to talk about a brand new Australian streaming service. Folks, really big episode. And frankly, I don't want to dilly-dally, so let's dive into the reviews.
It stinks.
My trip down to IMAX this week. In fact, there were two trips down to IMAX this week. I'll get to the second one in a couple of weeks.
We get it, Simon.
I love the IMAX. I love IMAX, and I was very excited about seeing the new Ridley Scott film Napoleon in IMAX because everything that I'd heard about the film was that it's the bigger screen, the better, is that it's a massive spectacle with all sorts of incredible horses being hit by cannonballs and men being splayed all over the fields of Waterloo by cannon fire and horse being trampled, and it's all this massive stuff that I know Ridley Scott loves doing well. But when I saw the film, we got to about the two-hour mark, and I realized that this is very much the latest bit of high-end hackery from a man who loves putting in spectacle, but doesn't know how to tell an engaging story, and certainly doesn't know how to get inside the head of his character. Dan Barrett, I see you've raised your hand.
Did you actually mention the name of the movie, and or did you throw to a clip? Because I don't think you did either.
All right, let's do that right now. It's called Napoleon. Here's a clip.
General, we are discovered.
Good.
Wait!
Spies! It's a trap! Retreat!
I'm not built like other men.
All right, good to be back from the clip. Probably very spectacular. I don't see what goes into these clips, and I'm sure it's fine. Dan does a good job of picking them. But it stars Joaquin Phoenix giving a performance that could be best described, that could be generously described as understated, could be more accurately described as kind of flippant and a little bit boring at both the same time. The movie tries to create more than just spectacle by examining the love affair, the love of his life that he has with Josephine, played by the always reliable but terribly underused in this part, Vanessa Kirby. And what you have is a film that wants to be a bit of an intimate love story about obsession and about the great love that the man himself could never really feel for anyone other than himself. But what you get is a 2.5-hour, $200 million adaptation of the Wikipedia page. It really just bounces from key moments in the historical life of Napoleon, interspersed by completely unconvincing, completely chemistry-free moments between Josephine and the man. It's really just a 2.5-hour take on small man syndrome. In that regard, some critics have gotten behind it, and I think it's sort of floating around at 62% now, the same Rotten Tomato score as The Marvels, I might point out. And it is a little bit insulting for Apple and Sony to put it into cinemas on the basis that this 2.5-hour version is going to be as good as the 4-hour version you're going to see on Apple TV in a few weeks' time. Now, that is a really cynical bit of marketing to try to pull off, just to sell it as a spectacle and to be seen on the big screen before we maybe tell a better story on the small screen. I'm not going to return to it. There's no 90 minutes that could be added to this that would make me want to watch the longer version. So I'm kind of glad I saw it on the big screen, but I'm not particularly excited that I saw it at all.
Okay, so a few things to unpack. I've seen this feature film as well. Mm-hmm. So a couple of things. I think, first of all, it's very nice of you to acknowledge that this is a movie that's made for Apple TV, and you're not supposed to see it in the cinema, because a certain person was telling me the other week that The Killer, made by David Fincher, shot with the idea it would be watched on Netflix, was to be viewed in the cinema. So I don't understand what's different here. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. The other thing is that this is an incomplete movie, and this is the same thing that Ridley Scott's done a couple of times now with his very big historical epics, which is that he generally has a director's cut in mind, and they usually go fairly long. So the version that gets released in the cinema notoriously is less good than the much longer director's cut that will follow. Unless I'm mistaking this, and, you know, lots of things circulate through my brain for a second and a half and sort of move on. In fact, that's most things. I believe that he said something along the lines of that he doesn't know if the 4-hour version is going to be cut into like a mini series, like a chapter based serial, or if it will actually be a movie coming through. But, you know, he's certainly playing around with the fact that, yes, he's made this for Apple TV and it provides him a few opportunities to, you know, do something with it. Look, this is an incomplete version, and I'm going to be actually fairly interested to see what's going on, because I think I probably enjoyed this a little bit more than you did. In the greatest, like, I've got a fairly sort of patchy relationship with Ridley Scott. There's a few of his films that I absolutely adore, and then there's the rest. Some of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life have been Ridley Scott movies, but also some of the best movies. And to me, this is a filmmaker that usually sort of swings for the fences. And in this, I felt there was some swinging, but not quite to, like, it just didn't feel like it was as committed. So you seem to be very critical of this being a movie about small man syndrome. I wish this was more about small man syndrome. The story of Napoleon has been told a number of times, I think even once by Ridley Scott early in his career. I would be very keen to see him actually fully commit to this version of Napoleon, which was a guy who was very much in the current sort of parlance, a cuck in his relationship. He's someone who's desperately after the approval of mother, of every other person in his life. He seemed horribly inept. Basically, he was kind of fluking it from one situation to the next and managed to build up an amazing reputation as time went on. I kind of wish I saw more of that, but instead it just kind of flirted with that as an idea and then moved on to like the next large scale battle epic, which he came out successful with. So I don't know. I kind of want to see more of the humanity sort of between these scenes than what we got. And those epic battle scenes are epic. I think that these look like big screen action extravaganzas that admittedly would be lost a little bit on a small screen. I don't think that it would be a worse film for seeing it on a small screen, but definitely those scenes play remarkably well when you got the big sound and the much bigger screen in front of you. For those scenes, I quite enjoyed it. I just wish I got more of the other stuff if I wanted to have more of a satisfying film experience from this.
Yeah, I am hopeful that what you crave for, that sort of deep dive into the small man syndrome and more about the psychology and machismo, I guess you could say.
Just to be clear, I don't think I care about his psychology because I think I get it. I just really enjoyed those scenes where you're seeing Napoleon not as the towering figure of a war baron, but rather, you know, not as military strategist, but really as everyday flawed man.
Yes, that's interesting because I don't think that Scott or David Scarpa's script particularly handled the his skill as a military strategist particularly well. The one big scene's the attack on the lake. That really showed him ordering his infantry and his cavalry in from different sides of the lake. I thought was the only point in the film where you saw him totally in command of his troops and totally in command of the battle. When the Waterloo scenes came around, he was, you know, huffing and puffing and acting all scared, and he realized he was going to lose. And when he was finally captured, the man that he became was all about his arrogance, and none of which I found particularly interesting, either in the story of Napoleon the man or in the performance of Joaquin Phoenix, who is clearly in favor with his director, going all the way back to Gladiator, but I don't think does anything with the performance here. And I am totally on side with a lot of the French critics who have completely ripped him another one for this performance. One, I think one of them called him little more than a wax figure in this giant film. And I totally get that kind of criticism. So, I have been down on the big Ridley Scott historical spectacle for quite some time now. I didn't love Kingdom of Heaven. I certainly didn't love Robin Hood. There's been stuff
sorry, quick
along
clarification.
The way
that, Kingdom of Heaven, are you criticizing the director's cut or the regular version? Because that's what really plays into this conversation.
Yeah, I know. The original version, I hated in the cinemas. The much more positively received director's cut, I thought was fine. I thought was, yes, a better film, but still not a particularly engaging one. Maybe I was carrying a lot of baggage from having been so disappointed by the original version. So that this disappoints as a Ridley Scott film doesn't surprise me. That it probably falls so far short of what it could have been does a little bit. So there you go.
Yeah. For me, everything kind of worked. It just kind of felt like it wasn't a complete movie, even though like it seems complete enough on screen. But I mean, I just kind of know that there's more, and I feel that's going to plug in some of the gaps that I kind of felt existed in this film. So it's, I don't know, it's hard to even want to offer a proper opinion when I know that there's more to come, which is unfortunate. Sure.
I didn't do my research. Do you have a date in front of you for when this hits Apple TV? Because I know it's out through Sony
not
Pictures
in
fairly not announced as yet. Okay, so it's in wide
but look, it'll be ready for Christmas, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure they're keeping it quiet because they know people will wait for it. So, yes. Napoleon in cinemas now. What are you going to talk about?
I just wanted to backtrack just very briefly. I quite like the Joaquin Phoenix performance. I thought it was fairly strong. There's quite a number of other supporting actors through it who I quite enjoy that I thought were, you know, strong presences on screen. But the absolute standout for this is Vanessa Kirby. And while she probably isn't quite given as much to do, and again, I wonder if that sort of factors into the stuff that was missing from this edit of the film rather than, you know, what was provided to her. I think that, you know, she's clearly the character from this that people are going to remember. I just thought she was fantastic. And it's probably just an opportunity for me to, I guess, remind the world about the little hug I got from that one time. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Shall we move on, Simon, and talk about a new television program? It's, I mean, news very much a flexible phrase here. It's called Fargo Season 5.
Well, sir, there's no easy way to say this. Your wife isn't who she says she is.
Let me tell you what I see.
Trouble, oh, trouble.
I see a woman who outsmarted two kidnappers.
Are you okay, ma'am?
Dan Barrett, we have reached season 5 of Fargo. Now, we do have kind of a policy on this show where we don't go back and review seasons 3 through wherever the show should end up, but there's something very different about Fargo, isn't there?
Yeah, so you say we. I mean, it's very much me has that policy, generally. And I'll only really make exceptions for shows which maybe haven't been on for a couple of years that didn't necessarily have much of a profile to begin with, or just sure. those handful of shows that are very special favorites of mine that I think are still living up to the promise of the program. So you would notice I don't think I did a deep dive onto the most recent season of For All Mankind, because it just doesn't really quite live up to previous seasons.
Did you ever come around to watching the latest Crown season that you chastised your wife for last week for dipping into ahead of your schedule?
Haven't had time because the limited amount of TV time I've had has been shared viewing time and she's already seen it. So still haven't gotten to it.
Gee.
Very frustrating, gosh. Simon. But I digress. Imagine. You know what? It's interesting you mentioned the Crown just as a diversion. Right, just near the beginning of when we started doing this podcast, I remember the two of us getting into a fairly heated conversation where I was expressing my distaste for movies which were biopics. Okay, because me, I really didn't care for a lot of movies that were very much Wikipedia, the TV series, or Wikipedia, the movie, which most biopics really tend to fall into. So it's kind of nice that you've, you know, joined me on this little island I've been living on now.
Oh, absolutely. No, I never doubted that. Yeah. Biopics are not my thing.
Because I remember because I think I was talking about The Crown like a week or two after that, and you're like, oh, but you like The Crown, but you don't like biopics. Anyway,
it was like a year and a half ago.
Fargo season 5. Simon, 6 years ago, we were sitting in the foyer. No. Okay, look, Fargo, here's the challenge of talking about this program in that everyone kind of knows what the deal is with Fargo. This is a series where every season is, I think, entirely or at least mostly written by Noah Hawley. We know the Fargo TV series vibe and tone, which is slightly different to the Coen brothers, but, you know, they share, obviously, some... the series has some very obvious inspiration, which is the Coen brothers.
Yeah, certainly the new
I wouldn't say this is necessarily of the Coen brothers. This feels very much of Noah Hawley. So it is, you know, kind of, you know, what it is. It is an independent beast of a thing. So watching this, we're now 5 seasons in. We know what the tone of this is going to be. We know the general sort of spirit of intent. There's an opening tag in the new season because it takes place in Minnesota. And I think this is the most contemporary of all the shows. I think it's even more contemporary than that first season. But anyway, I can't quite remember exactly how many years prior that one had been set. This one's 2019 set. So it's just prior to the pandemic kicking off.
Very Trumpy but era,
this
very
show,
Trumpy.
Set in Minnesota, and it opens with a tag, which I read this tag, and I had to think to myself, is this a tag that has been on every season of the program so far, or is this one that's just been applied for this season? Because it applies to all the previous seasons as well, which is just this thing about a definition of Minnesota nice, okay? And it's just that idea that, you know, you always put up a face sort of being as polite and hospitable about something, despite how much it's caused you personal hardship or frustration.
However and forced so, it may be, yeah.
As forced as it may be, you will still do that. And it's really encapsulated at the very end of the first episode where the Juno Temple character, because this season's helmed largely with Juno Temple as the lead, she has been through just all sorts of hellish activity. In the opening seconds of this show, she's involved in a riot at the PTA meeting. She inadvertently tases a police officer. She spends some time in prison, like, you know, overnight, just in a watch house. She spends some time with her husband's family, who are exactly the sort of family where at Christmas time they take the family photo with rifles in hand. Not just rifles, some pretty serious machinery there in front of the Christmas tree. So that it's like a wealthy family. She deals with that. She ends up being brutally attacked in her home and kidnapped, and then has a Home Alone style fight out with the crims in a convenience store. She goes through a lot of shit in the 57-minute season opener. Okay, and then the final sequence is her coming home and her husband's like, oh, you know, what's going on? It seemed like there was some sort of skirmish here at the house, and she's like, no, everything's fine. And that's because she's Minnesota nice, represents. Anyway,
it's all there
I
on
really
the screen,
love that.
And she's wonderful. She's great, yeah.
She is. And like Juno Temple, I don't think she's necessarily the strongest of performers, but she's a very likable performer. And anytime she's on screen, like she's absolutely captivating, even though the performance is never really sort of that far removed from the previous performance. That said, everything here is probably locked down just a lot more than she usually is. She's usually sort of fairly bubbly and very much the energy and life force that exists in any given room and every other show and movie that she's in. Here, she's just kind of very, you know, buttoned down, just Minnesota nice through and through. With this season, I think that all that you can really do to, in terms of a review is this better than the previous season? And the answer is by far yes. Last season was just notoriously just didn't really fire off in the way that I think people wanted.
Bit underwhelming.
Creatively, it was kind of okay, but it just didn't have any spark or vitality to it. This season brings that back. It's definitely on par with seasons 1, 2, 3. It's back. There's some interesting visual flourishes taking place. It's got a really very impressive cast. You've got Juno Temple. Yeah. You've got John Hamm, the world's most handsome man, my future husband. You've also got, oh gosh, who else is in this? Dave Foley is in it in a very
Joe Keery from Stranger Things. Jennifer Jason Leigh is the bitchy sort of matriarch. And Dave Foley, yeah, he's terrific in the lead. So it's a quality cast. You're burying the lead bit in that if when we get to episode 2, you get a peek at John Hamm's how can we put this? Buttocks.
Ham.
That must have been leg of ham. Upper leg of ham, in fact. That must have been a thrill for you.
Well, truthfully, I actually haven't watched the second episode yet because...
No way! I spoiled it for you. Oh, it's quite a scene.
Oh, no, I knew about it because I've got news alerts set for John Hamm's derriere and then suddenly it just came up.
So in fact, all you've really seen is Juno Temple because Ham makes no appearance in that opening episode. Which, I mean, and it's a cracking opening episode. Now I come to this, and sorry, I'm jumping in here, but I haven't seen any of Fargo previously. A couple of episodes of the very first season, but I never dipped into it at all. It's just one I've never leaned into. So I was really happily surprised by the nods to the original. Coen Brothers film. There's plenty of those in here, from the two sort of tough guys to the car dealership to all these sort of things. I don't know if they do those nods in previous episodes of Fargo, but I got to say the opening two episodes of this I thought were really compelling, sort of modern crime kind of western.
Yeah, so look, the only reason I haven't watched the second episode yet was just literally because on Wednesday night when the episodes dropped, I was out seeing Napoleon for the 12-hour runtime that exists for, and then I only really got to it late on Thursday night because, Simon, I've got a job and a life that I have to attend to. So, TV, sometimes you get to it when you can.
Yeah, I guess that's very true. What was the other thing you went to this week? Some sort of media monitors thing about AI and all that sort of stuff? That read very interestingly.
No, that's something I wanted to go to, but it was on while I was watching Napoleon. So,
Fine. Okay.
Yeah. Talking about a Brisbane Hacks Hackers event where it was a woman talking about kind of the future of media distribution. Sounds anyway, fun. That's neither here nor there. Not part of the review, Simon.
No, we got distracted. Yeah. Do go on.
Look, I mean, that was kind of it. I don't really have a lot that I sort of feel I need to say about this one. I think sort of once you know the cast, and I think that for anyone who's familiar with the franchise, which I think is most people who'd be listening to a podcast like this or watching us on YouTube and Spotify, I kind of feel that most people have probably already bought in on Fargo or have decided it's not really for them because there's already been 4 seasons of this program. People aren't going to jump in on season 5. You'd have to be a complete psychopath to do that. But broadly, you want to know who's the cast in it. Is there anyone particularly sort of novel or great? And, you know, there was a bunch of great names we just rattled off. Is the show of the sort of expected Fargo level of quality? Absolutely is. Should you watch it, you know, I'll be there week to week on this one. It is a very strong opening and, you know, very promising for a season ahead.
I think it's really interesting, and I'll be brief about this. I think it's really interesting that it's set during the Trump years and that as a Trumpian male, John Hamm, as is revealed in the second episode, you may want to close your ears for this one, Dan Barrett, that sort of celebration of his own toxic masculinity makes for a really interesting take on the Midwestern man of a few years ago. So, tune in to see John Hamm be kind of a creep. All right, let's get on to the next one. I saw The Royal Hotel, a new film from Transmission Films.
It's not a very demanding job.
The only thing that can be a little bothersome is the remoteness of the location.
Will there be kangaroos?
We're in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
Down the back, up the stairs.
Down the back.
Up the stairs, mate.
You're the new girls.
Yeah.
Simon, before, it was nice of you to throw to the clip and actually name what the movie is this time. But I have to say, I actually have no idea what this movie is. I only just saw it on a rundown.
Okay. So this is an Australian film that young actress Julia Garner, who we know from, she did the miniseries about Anna Wintour. We know her. I know her particularly from The Assistant, which is the film from a couple of years ago that Kitty Green, the Australian director who also has done The Royal Hotel, made with her. The Royal Hotel is based on the documentary from a couple of years ago called Hotel Coolgardie, which examined the story of a couple of young women who took a sort of like a backpacker's job at a hotel, a pub deep in the mining territories of Western Australia, and found themselves at the whim of a whole lot of, once again, toxic masculinity and horrible notions of what men can be like when they hit the piss in their times off. In this one, she's teamed up with Jessica Henwick, and they both play these backpackers who take jobs as barmaids. Daniel Henschel is the local creep who starts to really freak them out. The bar is owned by Hugo Weaving, who puts in some of his better acting over the last few years. And it's how the escalating nature of that alcohol-fueled sort of good time vibe that the Australian pub has engendered over the years can take a very dark turn very quickly. And I say very quickly advisedly because it takes kind of a while for this film to get round to those moments. Julia Garner is instantly frightened of everyone in the pub. Jessica Henwick isn't. It creates a bit of a rift in their friendship until things start to turn really nasty and the outcome sort of plays into some B-movie tropes that I didn't find very convincing, but it certainly makes for an entertaining film in a sort of a crazed outback kind of way. It's been compared a little bit to Wake in Fright, which I think it's a long way from achieving that kind of status, but to see these two young actresses and this young director play with the gender dynamic, between two young American lasses and a whole bar full of Aussie blokes has some interesting moments. Not a terrific film and not as important as it's been made out to be. This one opened the Adelaide Film Festival this time last year and it got some good reviews, but I don't think it's a particularly great film. Called The Royal Hotel from Transmission Films in limited release.
Yeah, Julie Garner, the breakout role of hers was obviously in Ozark, and then the Anna Wintour TV series you were talking about was Inventing Anna.
Inventing Anna, that's right. Yeah, Ozarks. I forgot she was the main character in Ozarks. Another show I've never seen. Boy, I really don't watch a lot of television, do I?
Yeah, you really should watch Ozark. I think you'd enjoy that one.
No, I would, yeah. Love a big bit of Bateman. All right, let's get on to you getting all red in the face and talking about what probably isn't going to be your favorite film, favorite TV show of the year. It's called Squid Game, The Challenge.
Attention all players. It is now time for the next game.
Oh, yo!
Oh, my God.
Please enter the game hall immediately.
What is this?
Damn.
Oh, my God.
Let the game begin.
Simon, I haven't hated a reality show as much as this since I saw 007 The Road to a Million.
That was only like 2 weeks ago.
Fuck, that show was awful, and this may be even worse.
Oh, no.
I really, really hated this. And I know you've watched 5 episodes of this, and I have to ask, how and why? First of all, did you watch Squid Game? You've seen that?
No.
Okay, well, this may be the reason for it. Okay, so Squid Game, The Challenge, the premise of it is that this is another one of those reality shows, which is as far from reality as you can possibly get. Over, I believe it was a 16-day shoot, they ended up filming what I think is like about 10 episodes of this reality program. So the first 5 episodes have dropped, and then we get another 5 next week sometime.
November 29th.
With this, what they are doing is effectively all those games that they played in the fictional Squid Game TV program. They've got the 200 odd people that supposedly played Squid Game in the TV show. But this time it's a reality program. And so people are confronting those exact same challenges that we all saw on the popular South Korean TV program, but for real everyday people to watch. The problem with this program is that it is so overfilmed and overwrought, where they've tried to wring out as much drama from it as possible, to the point where you've got people who aren't acting like actual people are. Instead, they're acting like they are acting in a television program. And so you kind of have to think, what is the point of this show? Because I can't work it out. What I saw was that have moments where... And okay, this is also a thing that's kind of stupid and why people don't actually really behave this way. Each of these people are competing for what I believe is the most money that's ever been offered on a reality TV program. Okay, and if you think about Squid Game, the awkward thing about Squid Game was that people who didn't win games largely got brutally murdered and weren't necessarily with us for much longer than, you know, playing that game. So in order to do that, people are hit with paintballs and sort of similar types of things throughout this. And so once you've been hit with the paintball, you're dead. So you fall to the ground. It's like, I'm dead. But then people overperform their deaths. And then you've got other people who are watching like brutal carnage taking place. And they're all there going, oh no. And like really sort of acting. The thing is that one, it doesn't make any sense, because why are they so invested in that? Two, they should actually be happy that all these other people are being killed, because it means that they've got more of a chance of getting that $4.7 million. So it doesn't make any sense from any angle that you look at this thing. But from the broadest angle, which is that it's a reality TV program, you're just watching all these people who, you know, that as soon as the sequence has taken place, they've said, okay, you group of people, act as though you're horrified or deeply upset or whatever emotion they're trying to convey. And so they convey that emotion. And it's like, well, why am I watching this? Why wouldn't I just watch the original series of Squid Game, which is better constructed with greater tension and actual stakes in it, okay, as dramatic as they may be, as opposed to this bullshit reality show that has no weight or value to it whatsoever? Simon, defend this, because you've watched 5 episodes.
Give me right of reply. Now, I preface this by saying...
Well, I don't know why you get right of reply, but go ahead and give a reply.
Good Lord. Give me a few moments. Keep sucking on your drink there. I got 2.5 episodes into Squid
Game. My mouth and not sucking. There's no straw mechanism. Jesus, Dan, Simon.
Dan, just mute for a moment. I need a moment. I watched 2.5 episodes of Squid Game. I haven't watched any of Survivor since the very first season. I was kind of a fan of Big Brother in the first few years, and then I haven't watched any of it. So for me, this kind of...
Is that
of
when they stopped doing the Friday night nudie shows?
That's exactly when I stopped watching it. So weighing in on this as someone who's never seen Survivor, who's has a fleeting interest in Big Brother, which is kind of this, the combination of what this show is, the premise and the sets and the original concept certainly comes from, you know, the Squid Game world that the series recreated. But in every other respect, it's just a spin, a variation, a new coat of paint on the Survivor sort of tack. They create alliances, they have to do tasks, they have to, and I should point out, they're not paintballs. I think they actually have little explosive pop devices attached to their collar that pop out and explode.
Okay, first of all, that'd be amazing if it was wedlock, the challenge, and you get to see
wedlock
heads
blow
their
heads off. Yeah, that would be awesome. So the one thing that I did warm to in this was that I wasn't asked to become completely engaged with a small group of characters, but on an episode by episode basis, I was introduced to new people with different narratives, different personalities. People turn up in episode 4 and 5 that you didn't know had even been in the game to that point. There is a sort of a through line of characters that you start to follow, and that emerges as the series will go along. But on each episode, I was introduced to a new person and a person with new skills, which I found kind of interesting. That made it a more episodic engagement than something like Survivor, where you're only really picking from, you know, 12 or 15 people or whatever it is, and having to commit to a full season too. So I didn't mind those elements. I found the way that they told the sort of twisted the screws on some of the tasks to be really interesting. I thought the Battleship episode was really good. And the only thing that where I think it started to fall apart was that it became more of a game of chance. Contestants were given opportunities to eliminate other contestants, so you can really try hard to win something, but then maybe you might get knocked out anyway. So I didn't sort of warm to that part of it. But I did find myself becoming kind of engaged with both the concept of it, where they're all living together, and some of the characters they introduced. If it's all fake, which I'm sure 95% of it is, it's still made for a fairly entertaining version of that kind of reality show.
No, this movie's complete trash. I think, Simon, you would be better served actually going and watching something like Survivor, watching something like Big Brother. And the thing is, all these reality shows have a large amount of artifice that are built into it, and a lot of manipulation that takes place. Probably less so with something like Survivor than the rest, but, like, you know, I'm not from a farm. You know, I know how TV works. Like, there's certainly manipulation taking place, even if the strings less apparent on one of the more prestigious things like Survivor than some of the other trash where people marry a farmer or whatever the case might be.
Yep.
However, that said, like, all of this is just staged and overshot and made to look as filmic as possible. And to my mind, if you're going to make this program, why don't you actually just sort of lean into what the actual joy is of a Squid Game reality show taking place? Sorry, can you hear that garbage truck?
Not really, no.
No, okay, I'm just going to keep going. Why not lean into what actually makes a Squid Game reality show work, which is that, hey, it's actually kind of fun doing these silly childish games, which we saw in this TV series, which had a whole bunch of unfortunate deaths. Why not actually have characters
who are... But then it becomes Wipeout.
What? No, no, Simon.
But then it becomes Wipeout, the TV show.
No, it's not, though. I'm saying, why don't you have characters that actually acknowledge that there's a TV show called Squid Game and that it's kind of fun playing in, like, the real world? Like, actually sort of go, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is ridiculous fun. Like, it's gone. Like, actually, don't try to make this a dramatic conceit. Instead, think about this more in terms of the show The Floor is Lava, where they know that it's silly. Just play up and amplify the silliness.
But the stakes are too high. You're talking
about the fake game show of Squid Game as an actual game show. Like, what's the point of that? You've already got the better version in the scripted version as opposed to the fake scripted version.
Because there's $2.75 million at stake in this game show. That is as you said yourself, it's the highest prize ever in a game show format. And I'm not going to keep calling it a reality because it's not a reality show. I don't think we should keep calling it reality.
But you can still do that with, like, a fun version of the show. I think you just need to take it a few steps removed from what they've done here, because what they've got here on the screen is just a lesser version than a scripted TV program. Like, what is the value? Why would I waste 5 hours of my life doing this? I've got a lot of episodes of LA Law I could be watching instead.
All right, Squid Game The Challenge is on Netflix. You may have to make up your own minds about this. Do you think it will have the same pull as the scripted version? I mean, it came out of nowhere at the early days of pandemic and was a sort of a whole thing unto itself in terms of a phenomena. Will Squid Game The Challenge sort of tap into that audience, or will they get Lava is the floor numbers?
Look, I mean, okay, first of all, you just opened up a couple of conversation points there. So I guess maybe the first question is, will this be as well received as the Squid Game original series? Let's go to the arbiter of all websites, of all, like, online sort of metrics, which is RottenTomatoes.com. Critics have given us 42%, and the audience score, which the audience score is often counter to what critics have to say. Like, audiences often love something that critics hate. Audiences hate this even more, 24% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Look at me flying the flag for the minority. That's what I do.
Yeah, apparently. So look, there's that. And then the other thing as well is that when Squid Game originally launched, I thought it was fine. I was never gaga for it. There's certainly elements that I really liked about it, but there was just some of the pacing and execution I thought was just a little bit awkward and shonky, and there were just a few narrative gaps in the series that didn't make a lot of sense to me. But also, I watched it under really weird circumstances in that I was pandemically locked down to a maternity ward where I'd just given, well, I hadn't physically done this, but my child had just been born. And we were watching this like hours after being in like a maternity situation. I'm so overwrought with emotion right now, Simon. I can't even make my way through this. I can tell
you're quite worked up. Take a sip. I'll take a sip too. Take a sip, everyone who's listening.
Everyone, this is the screen watching drinking game now. You know, has everyone taken their shots?
Oh my God.
I watched Squid Game in a really sort of bizarre circumstance. And so, you know, I saw it for, you know, the best way I could possibly watch it at that time. So my experience is quite different to most people watching it, sure. I think. But broadly, everyone was watching it like a weird time in the world's existence.
Yeah.
In this, I think everyone can leave the house and do other things, and I would strongly recommend they do that instead of watching Squid Game, The Challenge.
You know what? I will just point out very quickly, and this is going on long, but I will just point out this very quickly. Everyone sort of weighed into their love of Squid Game because they hadn't seen the great Japanese film Battle Royale, which it was a lot of it was based on. I'm weighing into, on a positive note, for Squid Game, The Challenge, because I haven't watched any of those games. I don't watch Survivor or any of their
shows. You haven't watched television.
Maybe Squid Game The Challenge has a certain charm or pull or interest to me because I'm not overdone with the 12 or 20 seasons of The Survivor or whatever it is. So,
the takeaway is if you have been in solitary confinement for the last 25 years and not seen any television during that time, watch Squid Game The Challenge. You'll love it.
I'm quite the entertainment hermit, aren't I? I do just want to mention briefly that last Sunday evening, as part of the British Film Festival here in Sydney, I was fortunate in inverted commas, to see Caligula, The Ultimate Cut. Now, those of you who know my love of the great cinema folly will also know that Caligula holds a very specific place in that lexicon, because it was an upmarket attempt to create a very real version of Roman debauchery made by Bob Guccione, the penthouse magnate, back in the late 70s. It started shooting in 76, although it didn't hit our cinemas till early in 81 or late in 80. He got a bunch of big cast members, Malcolm McDowell in the lead role of Caligula, Helen Mirren, Peter O'Toole, John Gielgud, an original script by Gore Vidal. They made this film, and then when all the stars went home during the day, he put in a whole bunch of penthouse pets at night and shot a whole lot of orgy scenes. So at the end of the production, they suddenly found themselves with an X-rated, star-laden historical epic that became instantly notorious. In the ultimate cut, they've removed all those scenes. They've tried to get all the penthouse pet scenes. They've found a whole lot of other footage that had been cut out of the original version that they've remastered and put back into this one to try to get it as close to the original Gore Vidal script as possible. It runs for just shy of 3 hours. I thought it was amazing. My better half thought it was insufferable. It is one of the great follies. It's going to come out through Umbrella Entertainment in a few weeks' time, I think. And I think it's definitely worth a look because it still has some pretty extraordinary stuff in there. But Caligula, The Ultimate Cut, probably isn't quite as dark and as nasty as it needs to be to maintain its legacy as a version of Roman history, but as a sort of snapshot of what a lot of money can buy you in the late 70s to make any kind of film you want, it certainly comes across on that front. So Caligula, The Ultimate Cut, due from Umbrella Entertainment in the months ahead.
I found that delightful. I really enjoy the way you're like, oh, because, you know, I really love follies. What Simon's not sharing is that he loves turning on his TV screen and just seeing people.
That's exactly what it is.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Dan Barrett, during the week, we welcome to the Australian streaming landscape a new player. The aforementioned Umbrella have launched their new streaming service, Broly. and it offers up a library that ought to be of interest to the discerning screen watcher. Umbrella, for those in the know, have a lot of back catalogue stuff, a lot of Ozploitation, a lot of documentary, a lot of classic films from the day. So I thought it would be a good idea to not only cast an eye over this new streamer in terms of what they're going to offer up, how it plays on your devices and what Broly will face in this very crowded streaming landscape. I hand over to you to do a lot of that. You covered a lot of this very spectacularly well in your newsletter this week. Do go to the website to check out some of Dan's thoughts. He did come up with the amazing title Hello Broly, which is far cleverer than anything you've ever done. So I've stolen that for this segment. So tell us what your initial thoughts on the launch of Broly in this crowded streaming landscape is.
So look, ultimately, it's a streaming service. It's free to access for the moment, at least. They haven't really talked about what their end game really is, and I can't help but feel they're planning for this to be a subscription service at some point, but I'm not too sure. It's all, I don't know. It's a bit mysterious, the ambition.
So it's got ads in it now? It's ad-supported?
No, it doesn't seem like it's ad-supported, and from what I could see about the play mechanism of it, it didn't seem like it was built with any ad-serving technology in it. So I'm not too sure. There certainly wasn't any ads in the couple of things I clicked play on yesterday morning when I was giving it a bit of a road test. Look, I don't know what the financial model is, but if you right now you want to log onto a website with a fairly broad range of movies, the sort of movie where if you're listening to a podcast like Screen Watching, I can't help but feel that this is a platform that's exactly for our audience. I can't help feel that, Simon, that if you did a bit of market research around who listens to this podcast, you'd find out that it's almost certainly overwhelmingly male, and you'd probably also find that it's probably sort of men, 35 plus would be my guess, okay? It's a very sort of dude-heavy podcast.
Very niche.
Yeah. I mean, not niche. I mean, we do account for 50% of the gender split in the world. Okay, but
I'm reminded of the nuts and gums in a can joke from The Simpsons. I'm a white 35-year-old male, nuts in a can. Everyone listens to me.
I mean, there used to be a certain sense of truth to that, but not sure how true that is anymore. Certainly, that's not the way it plays out in my household. But look, if you are after a mix of art house movies, some cult action, sort of dude oriented movies, some horror,
some good
offbeat
horror.
You're well covered within the library here. It operates on three pillars. There's movies, there's TV shows, there's documentaries. The movies library is very heavy in content. The TV library, there's maybe 10 titles and none of them watchable. And then you've got the documentary.
No, I disagree with that. Let me just say very quickly.
We'll get to that in a moment, Simon. But anyway, you've got a documentary section, which has got a few more titles in there, but certainly not much more than a TV does. But the film library, really, really quite comprehensive in terms of just having a lot of options to get through. That is kind of really the place to, find some content here. I've been sort of quietly advised that, yes, the TV section will grow out a little bit more. Now, before we get too much further, Simon, defend the TV section because, really, I don't know how you do that. Go.
Very small. I'm not going to argue that as a launch sort of page to drop on, there's not a lot to choose from, but there is some quality stuff. There's 12 titles to choose from, but there is some stuff in there that for a certain demographic of the audience, something like Robbery Under Arms with Sam Neill, the miniseries Sarah Dane, A Town Like Alice, certainly, the Eureka Stockade, as well as Heath Ledger's first TV series, Sweat, are notable inclusions that haven't seen the light of day on streaming. I'm not saying they're groundbreakers or any specific reason to go to this platform immediately, but to see those get a streaming release is kind of heartening.
Yeah, but when those are the best titles you've got to offer in your TV section and the rest of it's rounded out with Skippy Season 1, which we've been able to watch every morning at 3:30 a.m. on Channel 9 for the last 40 years, two Ronnies in Australia.
I won't hear a bad word.
Again, there's the Heath Ledger Sweat series, which nobody watched that when it was originally on. No. And now, if you are interested, it's only for the Heath Ledger aspect, and you might watch one or two episodes before thinking, I see what's on offer here. I forgot about the 21 episodes of All Together Now, which is also streaming over on Amazon.
Yeah. I would point out that I know that Apple have got a really strong catalog of TV back catalog. So I think that's probably going to grow in weeks to come. But Sarah Dane was a big deal back in the day. That and Robbery Under Arms and Town Like Alice were at the height of the Australian miniseries boom back in the late 80s. So anyway,
yeah, but again, checking Simon, out.
But yes,
but Simon, you look at some of those really good movie titles that are sitting in the movie library and then compared to what's
absolutely,
in the
TV
section, like it is just
no argument, you know,
chalk and cheese.
No argument. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so what I thought we'd maybe do, okay, so just briefly, if you want to check out some movies, the library here, like, it's fairly robust. You'll find a bunch of titles you probably want to check out. Ultimately, though, it's probably not all that different to stuff you've probably seen on SBS On Demand is probably the point of comparison here, in that it's a very SBS On Demand-y sort of a collection of content
got
here.
That feel. Less even foreign got that language. Look to it.
Yeah, it does. It's less foreign language, I guess, although not completely removed foreign language content. But, you know, you'll find movies like Another Round, for example, sitting in the library here. It's like that sort of stuff gets a play, along with a bunch of Australian classic Ausploitation films and some horror and whatnot.
A lot of those, yeah. I mean, Umbrella are the go-to people for the Ausploitation stuff. A lot of those will be remastered and good to look at.
Yeah, and look, totally cool. I'm happy that this exists as a service, but ultimately, you know, if you log on, click play on something on the website, it'll play quite nicely. Download the app, the Broly app. If you play it on iOS and watch it in Wi-Fi, you'll be able to watch stuff. But if you want to watch something, say, on the train, for example, you can't download anything and you can't stream anything via the app, which is baffling, absolutely baffling.
Yeah, that seems odd.
Okay. Yeah, so why even
bother? So maybe phase two. But maybe phase two of this launch will be where we get a real idea of
their ambitions. Phase two, sure, but also, yeah, phase two, sure, but like phase one is really where you should have fundamental basic things like being able to stream a movie through their app. That said, if you want to stream a movie on the go, you can just load the website through the web, like through your web browser on a mobile, and it'll still work. So you've got that access, but it's still weird to release a app for it when you can't support it properly, and also a TV section when you're not supporting that properly. That said,
if we had to pick three movies. Yeah, if we had to pick three things for our friends out there on Screen Watching Land to watch, what would you start with?
Are we going to do like 1-1 or?
Yeah, let's do a 1-1.
Okay, my sort of first pick, I want to do more than three, but I'd probably throw out there a film which is, I think, probably fairly underwatched and certainly super niche, but I think probably plays well to a screen watching type crowd. Under the Silver Lake, which you've seen this, surely, haven't you, Simon?
I saw it at Dendy Newtown. Yeah, I've seen it, absolutely. In the three sessions it had in Sydney cinemas.
Yeah, look, super divisive film. Some people really love it. People just outright hate it. It's from the guy that did It Follows. Have I got my filmmaker right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to think of what his name was.
David Robert Mitchell.
Yes, that was him. Yeah, no, it's definitely him. Yep. And stars Spider-Man.
Yeah, Andrew Garfield, the one true Spider-Man.
Exactly right.
The most successful of the film Spider-Man.
Strange film. Stunning film to look at. It looks beautiful. I hope they've done the transfer justice because it's a gorgeous film. But yes, very odd film.
Yeah, it's a sort of slacker noir detective film of sorts that takes you down some very sort of if Wikipedia browsing on the internet became a movie, that's kind of what this is, but with also drugs and nudity and a bit of violence.
If Big Lebowski met Chinatown at the turn of the millennium, that's kind of what Under the Silver Lake is.
If Big Lebowski was made for that weird guy you find in a record store who just wants to go through the liner notes of the record and talk to other weird guys in the record store about those liner notes, that's what this movie is.
That's exactly right. Okay, it's called Under the Silver Lake. It's on the Broly platform right now. I'm going to go back to 1992 and a little film that only had a relatively small release in the day, despite it being directed by Gillian Armstrong and starring a bevy of terrific local actresses, Miranda Otto, Kerry Fox, Lisa Harrow, and German import Bruno Ganz. The movie's called The Last Days of Shane New. It's about life in a inner city, I guess not quite a squat, but certainly at a time when gentrification was starting to take over the inner city, this is the this is a version of family life that we don't see a lot of on the screen, not often spoken of as a Gillian Armstrong film. And, of course, because it's an Australian film from the early 90s, it also features Bill Hunter. So it's on the Broly platform and definitely worth a look.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I was going to mention just a couple of the shameless sort of nods to my youthful watching. So the first three live-action Ninja Turtles movies are all on there, along with Super Mario Brothers.
Yes, I know. That's so weird. They've given that. Well, didn't Umbrella do a big that's fully remastered and one of the only ones in the world, or the first one in the world, to give it a big launch?
So, are you talking about Super Mario Brothers?
Super Mario, yeah.
Oh, maybe. Not sure.
Yeah, it really was. I'm going to jump to another Aussie film called Celia from 1989. This is sort of the story of it's an early version of the Babadook, many say, in that it's about a young girl played by the wonderful Rebecca Smart, who is having terrible troubles with her home life and imagines a world and imagines a creature that may help her, but she soon loses control of this aspect of her life. Also starring Nicholas Eady, who sort of fell off the radar a little bit, but he's terrific in this, directed by Ann Turner. I missed this one on original release and only watched it a few years ago and was totally blown away by its version of the horrors of family life. So check out Celia.
Yeah, and I'm just going to drop, I could probably mention that there's the three Jackie Chan Police Story movies in there, which I'm pretty keen to check out. Yeah. But instead, I'm going to talk about the fact that Fred Skepsy's The Devil's Playground is streaming on.
Oh, my goodness. Broly. Wow, I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah, and if people don't know this, it's a look at sort of the men of the Catholic Church, but it's not about pedophilia in the way that a modern version of this would be. In fact, there was the TV series Devil's Playground, which was very much that. Instead, what this is, it's basically looking at sort of, I guess, the sexual repression of men sort of who decide to take on the collar.
Yeah. And finally, I'm going to mention from 1980, one of the great unsung Ausploitation films. In fact, it sort of bridges the area between serious sort of socially minded film and Ausploitation. It's called The Chain Reaction, directed by Ian Barry. It stars Steve Bisley, who is a man who's chased out of his bushland getaway by some nasty people who are trying to cover up a nuclear leak in a nearby power station, because you always have your bushland getaway right next to a nuclear power plant. Having said that, it leads to a whole lot of terrific chase scenes. It's got a really propulsive, driven sort of action movie energy about it. Was kind of got lost a little bit in the Mad Max craze at the time and didn't get much of a run at cinemas, but you ask any of the Ausploitation fans from the period, and The Chain Reaction is one of the beloved sort of action movies of the day. And Bisley, as a young buck, as a superstar in the making, is just terrific in this. So it's called The Chain Reaction. So I have gone with a bunch of old Aussie ones, but that's kind of what Umbrella does best, and Broly will provide an endpoint for a lot of people who don't already have these on DVD.
Yeah, look, amazing we got through the segment without once talking about Turkey Shoot.
I almost mentioned Turkey Shoot. And I should point out that in the launch bunch of movies on Broly are a whole lot of the movies we mentioned in our Halloween show a couple of weeks back. You've got Possession in there. You also have, what was the other one? Martyrs, I think I mentioned. There's a couple of ones you can catch up on that we mentioned in an old show. So a lot of bunch of good movies.
Indeed. Simon, let's move on. We've got some, was it This Week in History? Is that where we're going? Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Let's do This Week in History. The beloved segment This Week in History. I think you'll get all these. I think this is a walk-up start for you. November 26, 1942. Dan, I was 7 years old. Which Hollywood classic, the film that would go on to win the Best Picture Oscar and rank number two on the first American Film Institute's 100 Greatest American Movies list, premieres at New York's Hollywood Theater, November 26, 1942.
Okay, so it's not 1941, so it's not Citizen Kane.
No.
42, I'm pretty sure, aligns with Magnificent Ambersons being Orson Welles' follow-up film, but I don't think that would make it to number two on the AFI list. Like, it'd make it onto the top 100, I would assume, but I don't think it'd be number two, which is a shame because that film is a stone-cold classic. And obviously, I always think about Orson Welles. I mean, just generally in life. Third Man was like 49, so that's not right. Casablanca. That's 42, right?
Yep. Casablanca. Yep. Well done, sir. It was Casablanca, the classic film. Speaking of classics, November 27, 1964, the late television director Robert Butler, who we both penned lovely obituaries for in the past week, just passed away recently. He was doing what on this day, November 27, 1964?
Look, everything that I think that he is really best known for was more like 1966. So I'm a little bit stuck on this one. Oh, 64, like he directed some Twilight Zones, but I'm pretty sure that Twilight Zone finished in 64. So at least the first incarnation of the Twilight Zone. So it's probably not that, because this is what you said, November. Because it was like this year. Not that. Maybe directed a Mission Impossible or something. I don't know. What are we talking about here?
November 27, 1964 was the first day of shooting of The Cage, the pilot episode of Star Trek, which was never actually aired, but bits of which were aired in the first episode that went to air a couple of years later.
I didn't realize that they would have been shooting that so early.
There you go.
Because Star Trek's another 66 series.
We didn't mention the passing of Robert Butler.
I suppose because failed pilot,
Yeah, if you had to rattle off a couple of Robert Butler's best-known accomplishments, launched Moonlighting, launched Remington Steele, directed so much television over the years.
Well, also pilots of the Batman TV series and Star Trek.
There you go. Exactly right. So he's a huge name. December 1, 1985.
Also, director of the feature film, The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes.
That's exactly right. I'm glad you mentioned it because I would have. Based on the beloved books by Lucy Maud Montgomery, which miniseries starring Megan Follows debuts on Canadian television? It was actually a Canadian production. So Lucy Maud Montgomery wrote the books. Megan Follows was the star.
Well, you would assume that it is a Canadian TV series because this is a Canadian icon, the likes of which, I mean, are there bigger Canadian icons than this? Maybe Ed the Sock, but that might be about it. We're talking about the Anne of Green Gables, if I'm not mistaken.
Ah, beautiful. Megan Follows. Wasn't it? That was a beloved TV series. When back in my video store days, we had like two copies of that and they were never on the shelf. And people would know when the person who rented it, they would know the day that they would bring it back. So they'd turned up and they go, have they brought back Anne of Green Gables yet? So a beloved miniseries. True boring story. Okay, let's go to birthdays.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
This is a tough one. I don't think you're going to get this, but let's give it a go. November 25, 1971, Christina Applegate. November 28, 1984, my movie wife, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. November 29, 1962, Andrew McCarthy. And December 1, 1951, the late Treat Williams. Now, how can I best word this? In fact, what did I say on our Facebook page that sort of summed up what these...
Just to put this on the record as well, when Simon says on our Facebook, it's very much Simon's Facebook.
Yeah, I know you don't like being associated with Facebook at all, and I know that I do all the Facebook, so I'm giving you a little bit of an in there. But I'm just saying this week our buds are all linked by a kind of character featured in one of their films. A kind of character.
Look, I know absolutely what two of them are, which I'm sure is the connective tissue. I just don't know what two of the films are that we're talking about.
Oh, that's a big call, Dan Barrett, leading into it. Let's see what he's got to say.
The thing is that we're talking about Christina Applegate, and Christina Applegate is known for like 2.5 projects, really. Okay. She is known for Married with Children. The other big one is, what is it called? Don't Tell Mum the Babysitter's Dead. Okay, and then the half is, I guess, starring in the 90s sitcom Jesse. So unless the other three actors all appeared in the show Jesse, or the actors have all appeared as a... or have all appeared in productions where there is a shoe salesman father and members of the No Ma'am collective, I would have to lean towards Don't Tell Mum the Babysitter's Dead. And the other like clear giveaway on this one is Andrew McCarthy, co-star of the absolute granddaddy, the papa bear of dead people on screen movies, Weekend at Bernie's 2.
Wow, tough call to drop number one.
So, quite clearly, they have appeared in movies opposite a dead person.
All right. So, you've got the answer. You're right. I'm going to give you this one. Mary Elizabeth Winstead was the love interest in Swiss Army Man. That's a clip. That's a photo of her on course. The Facebook page there. She was in Swiss Army Man. And Treat Williams played a corpse in the movie Dead Heat opposite Joe Piscopo. Dead, reanimated, still a corpse. It's a fine line, but I'm going to take it because it's my segment. So birthday quiz number 59, and they all played opposite or played dead things.
And also he's dead now.
Well, that's harsh. Come on, too soon. It happened like 6 weeks ago. All right. All right. I got to the end of another podcast. That's good. Those of you still listening, thanks. Hey, yeah, we've got episode 150 next week. Can you believe it? We've got to episode 150. How about that? Are we going to do something special or just mumble through another one? Or just drop things on the table while we're recording.
I'm concerned now I've alienated the family of Treat Williams.
Yeah, we'll get letters. Screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Sorry, Simon will get letters. I don't know the password to that email.
So for episode 150, write in and tell us your favorite screen watching moment from 150 episodes. We know we've got fans out there. Tell us what you'd like to hear again. We'll take the best 20 and Dan can edit them together into a best of clip. Good luck with that, Dan.
Like, as if there'd be 20 moments from this podcast that people could even recall, let alone like.
Literally from this episode of the podcast that they could recall.
I don't even remember what happened in this podcast now, and it's happening as we speak.
Exactly. Folks, right. Anyway,
this has been Screen Watching. Don't send us letters. You know, we'll do something. There'll be a musical number or something.
Mm. Yeah, that'd be good. We should write a ballad.
Or Simon can recount that tale where he remembered movies suddenly going from black and white to color. You know, we'll talk about something like that. But anyway, guys,
let's replay the episode where we had a fight with each other. That was funny. People still talk about the episode where we fought on air, which I thought you were going to cut out, but we decided to leave in.
Which one? We're not bonobos here, Simon. We're not bonobos, folks.
That's true.
This has been Screen Watching. This is Australia's number one bonobo-free podcast. Folks, we'll be back next week.